We're back with David Elkington, the author of The Ancient Language of Sacred Sound. David, we were talking about cymatics before the break, and we were talking about the meaning, the deeper meaning of certain words, and I kind of interrupted you midstream. I don't know if there was anything you wanted to pick up on that we left off with, or you tell me.
No, I was just going to say that, again, the way in which we take words for granted, you know, we only have to look at the meanings of them to understand and get a new sense of not only what the meanings of the words are, but also of where they come from, a new sense of the condition in which they emerged. You know, the word experience, we're all very used to that word experience, but of course in Latin, it's experare, which basically means from out of the spirit. I mean, you're going to have a tough time if you're an atheist using words, because a lot of them all seem to emanate back to what ancient man called the divine. So it's well worth having a dictionary by your bedside table and to look at the actual meanings of these words. It's a great game, and you can certainly pick up a lot of knowledge, a lot of information and wisdom from these wonderful right. objects.
In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So it reminds me, you know, this idea.
Doesn't that describe perfectly the fact that from the very beginning of all things, there was rhythmic vibration?
Right. It's almost as if, well, you know, we think of God sort of speaking the world into existence.
Exactly. And of course, the Latin for one word is universe.
Ah, amazing. The hits just keep on coming.
Absolutely. It keeps coming. This is exactly it. This is what emerged from the sacred site. This wonderment, this sense of awe of the fact that these things we call words, which we take so much for granted, contain so much. They tell us so much about ourselves and about the world around us. And so, all we have to do is to look at them and learn to love them.
When we're in a sacred place and we're you know, chanting during a liturgy, or the psalty is chanting, or, you know, if you're from the Buddhist tradition, the Tibetan throat singers, the Gregorian chants and so forth. What is that achieving? How is that affecting the human brain? Or even does it affect us at a cellular level?
It affects us on all levels. It's quite interesting. We had a wonderful Tibetan throat singer during one of our cymatic experiments in southern England. About 20 years ago, we did the experiment. And the throat singing is quite stunning. I mean, it really is quite amazing. The chap who was doing the singing was a very talented man called Jay Stillwell. And the patterns that were emerging in the cymatic drum were absolutely astonishing and very, very Tibetan in flavor, I hasten to add. But in terms of affecting us on a cellular level, sound does that. I don't know if you remember, but about 15, 20 years ago, there were a series of photographic books that came out from a Japanese author called Masaru Emoto.
Oh,
very
yes,
interesting.
Yes.
Very, very appropriate name, Emoto, because he was actually throwing emotions at water and then crystallizing it, and what you got was simply stunning. You know, if you threw something with love, you had a crystal that generally was very beautiful. It was well constructed, it was even, it was harmonic. But when you threw hate at these things, the way it created fractures and distortions was pretty remarkable, I have to say. So you only have to look at that to see what language can do. I mean, another good example perhaps is Adolf Hitler. If we look at the way in which he gave his speeches, the way he spoke, he would stand before his audience for 3 minutes when he was introduced, and he would say nothing. And of course, gradually the audience would get quiet, very silent, because there was a sense of tension rising. And then Hitler would start to talk with a very low voice, so you could barely hear him. So it meant that you had to arch forward to listen to his words. And of course, as he then got louder and faster and with more invective, it would really stir people to genuine hatred of whatever he was talking about. But by contrast, when you listen to the speeches of Winston Churchill, they're very calm, very reassuring, very measured, very wise, and they create that sense of resilience that the Americans and the British had during the Second World War when opposing Nazism. So you've got those two contrasts. Very fascinating.
Indeed.
And if we look on the brainwave level, if we look deep inside the brain, it was discovered about 15 years ago that very, very minute cells called neurides, which reside in a part of the brain, actually take the form of the alphabet here in the West. So in other words, the alphabet now is imprinted upon our very anatomy.
Wow.
That's absolutely fascinating.
It is. It is. You know, the a lot of the great composers, I think, were Masons, if I'm not mistaken.
I think they were. I think Mozart's the prime example of that with the magic flute, because if you listen to the magic flute, it's full of Masonic symbolism.
Right.
It's as well as being a wonderfully divine piece of music. I say that because, of course, you look at a composer's manuscript and generally it's full of ink blotches and crossings out and so on and so forth. But with Mozart, he seemed to download it direct from heaven because his manuscripts are perfect.
Well, yeah, you think of like I think you and I talked about his clarinet concertos the last time we spoke, and whether whether he had some, esoteric knowledge, like with using particular notes and the effect that those notes had, and perhaps that led to his, the effectiveness of his music and why it touched people so deeply, because he understood the power of certain frequencies on the brain.
I think subconsciously he did, for sure. It seems to me that from looking and hearing Mozart's music, you kind of get the sense that he was somebody who could immediately switch into an altered state. And there are people who can do that. There are very few and far between. But the great creatives like Shakespeare, Mozart, Beethoven, others, they had that ability to switch off and also to switch on. So it's quite fascinating. The fact that Mozart could write music that can actually calm whole classes of rowdy school children is quite phenomenal. And you can see this in all walks of life. It's quite interesting because in the pyramid, they discovered hundreds of mummified cats. The cat goddess was called Bastet in ancient Egypt. The Egyptians believed that by stroking a cat, you were in direct communication with heaven. And scientists and medical doctors particularly have shown that heart patients, people with heart trouble, if they have a cat or a dog and they can stroke the cat or the dog, they found that it can actually induce an instant alpha wave pattern in the brain, as well as creating a greater sense of relaxation.
Sure, I can attest to that. We have a pet rabbit, same thing.
Yeah.
That's first thing I do when I get up in the morning is set the breakfast table, and then I feed the rabbit, open up the cage, and I stroke the rabbit, and it does it. It relaxes me, obviously, but I'm sure it has an effect on my brain waves, no doubt. We were talking about Imodium.
Yeah. Animals are a bliss to have around, I have to say.
Yes.
I had a beloved dog, Eloise, who unfortunately passed away shortly before Christmas, and she was my great inspiration. She would just look at me and I could go into an instant alpha state and write. It was quite wonderful.
Amazing. Yeah, they're amazing creatures. We were talking about water. I just wanted to pick up on the idea of water encoding or storing information, and the connection then to people make pilgrimages to holy waters, whether it's the waters of Lourdes in France or maybe to the Ganges River. So what's happening there?
That's interesting you should bring that up, actually, because I write about this in the book. In the eastern part of England, in East Anglia, there is not far from the city of Cambridge a holy well called the Well of St. Wisburga. She was a Saxon saint. And it has certain properties to it, which was tested by the East Anglian Water Authority quite some time ago. They took tap water from the region, and they took river water from the region, and they took a sample of the holy well water. They then introduced bacteria into all three samples. In the river water, it took off. It just spread like wildfire. In the tap water, it did exactly the same. It grew, and it was healthy, it was blossoming, it was blooming. But once they introduced it into the holy well water, oh no, it was dead on arrival. It just, that was it, out, boom, end of story.
Wow.
And so we looked at the well water, and of course it's quite high in natural earth gas called radon gas, which of course is something you find very present both on its own and with water at the sacred site. So radon gas, if you breathe it in, obviously you don't want to do that on too regular a basis, but if you do breathe it in, it can make you quite high, as it were. So again, it changes your brainwave patterns. But it is interesting that ancient humanity, again, understood that holy wells were special, that they used the water as holy water, and they were able to use that in their liturgies. Or the genius of the Irish, only known people to have ever taken holy water and turned it into booze. They turned it into whiskey, and I have to say, I still use it as holy water to this day.
Indeed, indeed. Yes, medicinal purposes.
Absolutely.
We're going to open up the phone lines at the bottom of the hour and take questions and comments for David Elkington, The Ancient Language of Sacred Sound, The Acoustic Science of the Divine. Now it's 20th anniversary. What's new in the book over the last, 20 years that you've learned and you added?
Well, what I've done is I've taken away the initial four chapters from the original book because they were just not relevant to the overall thesis. And in the original book, there should have been a final two chapters, which I have now added. And I've updated the entire book as well and gone through the whole thing with a fine-tooth comb. I have to say, I think Inner Traditions have done a wonderful job on it. The cover is superb. And their editorial team were absolutely meticulous in the extreme. I have very, very high praise for them because this must have been a difficult book to work on, given that it's about language. So, of course, it would be a terrible irony if they came to print it and it was sort of typos and editorial and everything else. So, of course, that was very demanding for them. And I have to say, they've done a wonderful, wonderful job on it. And, of course, we have the foreword by Robert Watts, which is great fun. Robert is a really, really lovely man, and I have to say his foreword speaks volumes for the man himself. It's packed with information. Somebody described it once as encyclopedic. I hope it is, but in the same way, I hope it's readable. I hope that it tells the story well, and that although it's rich and it's intense in places, I think that people will be quite overwhelmed by the sheer amount of evidence that there is to back up my thesis, including the fact that the sacred site itself is generally built as an extension of the human body. I don't know if you know that, but
call
the church the body of Christ.
Yeah, that's true, yes.
If you look at the plan of the Gothic cathedral, you'll find that is precisely the case. It is like an extended human body. But that's not just unique to Christianity. If you go back to the Egyptians, they do exactly the same. The Temple of Karnak is more or less the Temple of Man, as Shlomo de Lubitz, a wonderful investigator into the Egyptian mysteries, stated back in the 1930s and 40s. It's if you look at the way in which the temple structure is built, it is obviously built to resonate the human body. So the way it does that is by taking us, human beings, and putting us inside greater human beings so that we can resonate to it can resonate to us. And so
that's fascinating.
So the whole idea of God being kind of like anthropomorphic, if you like, being almost human in structure, the divine comes to us through these places that are built to reflect both us and the divine.
Oh, that's fascinating. That's fascinating. This is going to sound like it's coming out of left field, and we may have to pick it up on the other side as we approach the break at the bottom of the hour. But crop circles and sound waves, people have been trying to figure out what are causing these agroglyphs, as some call them, in farmers' fields. You know, some suggest that they're UFOs and so forth, and others have suggested there's some sort of a plasma vortex. I don't know. Is it the Earth's resonant frequency that's causing these crop circles to form?
Yeah, I that's my theory for them. I have to say, I think the genuine ones are definitely forms of Earth resonance. I actually met a guy in a farmer's field. He was the farmer in the county of Dorset in southern England about 20 years ago. And he actually saw one of these things being made. And it was astonishing. He said it was like a vast orb of dew. He said it was the only way he could describe it. And he said as soon as he actually approached and looked at it, it collapsed.
My word.
Hey presto, in front of him was a partially made crop circle. It was quite astonishing.
That is.
If you consider that the Earth is so surrounded now by electromagnetic radiation, perhaps this is the Earth's way of getting back at us, of saying, hey, I'm trying to breathe here, you know, and it's sending us a message. I don't know.
Fascinating. All right. We'll take a time out, come back. As I say, we're going to open up the phone lines and take questions and comments for David Elkington, The Ancient Language of Sacred Sound, The Acoustic Science of the Divine, the second edition, the 20th anniversary edition. Back with more in a moment. Stay with us. All right. Welcome back. Let's go straight to the phones. And we welcome a first-time caller. April is in Minnesota. April, good morning. Welcome to Coast.
Hi. I had a question. So
yes.
Early in the program, you were talking about resonances and how they create symbols and sands in places like Celtic temples and the pyramids and stuff. And then you started talking about crop circles. So I was wondering if those are maybe also created by similar resonances, but from inside the earth and showing like a bigger deity and there's some type of religious symbol.
Good question, April. Go ahead. David?
Hi, April. Thanks so much for your great question. Yeah, I think you may well be onto something there. The first thing we have to think about, though, is that crop circles obviously appear in crops. They appear in wheat, barley, and rye. And it's interesting that wheat, barley, and rye are also associated with the hero legend. Now, the other interesting aspect of Earth resonance is that when barley is actually about to come into its fertile season, the whiskers, when they eject these little pollinators, which the bees can use, but barley is also fertilized by Earth resonance. And when the Earth resonance hits the landscape, when the sun goes down, so at sunset and at sun up. So what happens is that the resonance of the earth will then start to hit the whiskers and they will vibrate. And as they vibrate, they begin to actually fertilize the seed and therefore the barley can come to fruit, which is a curious one. So again, we have an aspect of the hero legend there as well. So in terms of crop circles, this is purely speculation, I hasten to add. I do think that there is a very intimate link with Earth resonance, and I suspect that the complexity of the circles themselves is to do with resonance being hindered by the amount of electromagnetic radiation we're using today in everyday communications. I hope that goes some way to giving you a bit of an answer.
April? I think she was listening off the air, but thank you. Great question, and terrific response. You mentioned the hero myth, and obviously that's central to ancient language of sacred sound. There's a section in the book called The Anatomy of a Hero, where you look at some of the commonalities between all of the great heroes, Jesus, Krishna, Osiris, Quetzalcoatl, the list is quite lengthy. What are some of those commonalities?
Well, the hero is born generally of the Earth Mother and the Sky Father, for a start. Then the hero actually has a miraculous childhood, and then you don't hear about him from his late teens onwards until he actually appears to then produce miracles and wonders. And then for some unknown reason, he's then put on trial and found guilty and crucified on a cross from which he rises from the dead after 3 days, and then rises to heaven to take his seat among the gods. So that's a legend that a lot of Christians will be very familiar with. And I don't want to actually alarm Christians, but what I will say is I think that Christianity, in looking at the Jesus, the legend of Jesus, the story of Jesus, reflects all of the hero myths, and that Christ, in that sense, is the fulfillment of them all, if I might say such a thing. Hence the reason why Christian ritual places, cathedrals and churches, are so very highly resonant. So we have the same in the Inca, Mayan, Aztec myths of Quetzalcoatl. His monument, of course, is the two great pyramids of the sun and the moon at Teotihuacan. It was discovered recently that these pyramids resonate to the cry of the Quetzal, that splendid emerald-colored bird that frequents the forests round about. How extraordinary, therefore, the Quetzal's cry is a list of vowel sounds that approximate the name of the hero.
Oh, my Lord. It's just, you go down this rabbit hole, it just never ends. Om, the sort of the ultimate mantra, Om, that many people might say in yoga class and so forth. What does that mean?
It's an expression of the creative sound from the very beginning. It's a bit like the beginning of John's Gospel. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. It's an expression of the divine consciousness at the very beginning of all things, and it spreads outwards in one vast waveform. So this is kind of like a connecting point for us to kind of get back into that resonant frequency, to connect with that which widens our sense of consciousness.
And it's often spelled O-H-M, and I think of ohm, I think of, in electricity we have ohms, which measure, I guess, resistance, right? Ohms. Is there any connection there, or am I connecting dots that aren't necessarily there?
I think it's a connecting thought that's not necessarily there, but however, it's great that you're getting the bug now of connecting words and seeing their relationships, and this is what we need to do, because this way then we accrue much more knowledge and wisdom to ourselves. And once you get the bug for words, it will never stop. Believe me, it'll become quite obsessive.
Oh, I had to redeem myself after primitive and meat. So,
I love that. I love that. I really do. You made me want to go out and buy a hamburger.
All right. Let's say hi. We'll go west of the Rockies, and Amelia's in Orange County, California. Good morning, Amelia. Welcome.
Oh, good morning, Richard and David. This is a vast body of work, David, for 20 years, and it's still never ending, and you can pronounce everything. I just compliment you so well. I want to practice asking questions because you guys do such good jobs. You kind of touched on my question about music a little bit, so I'm going to kind of adjust my question to say, David, I'd like to know what you think about, I'm very disturbed by these projects that are government or whoever does HARP, the High Altitude Aural Resonance Project, and some of this low sonar stuff that we apparently put through the oceans. I don't like it, but I'd like to know what you think about these things.
Amelia, it's a pleasure to hear you, and thank you so much for listening, and thanks so much for your kind words. In terms of what you've said, I'm in full agreement with you. I think this is very dangerous stuff for our planet, and I think it's truly awful what's happening. It seems to me to be such a tragedy that every time we discover something wonderful, something quite awesome, that the first impulse of humanity is to turn it into some kind of weapon or defense mechanism. We're permanently on the defensive. We don't need to be that. But one thing I will say is that the new environmental awareness that's shaping policy around the Earth today is beginning to have quite a considerable effect against these things, and is making our politicians a bit more sensitive, not only to the way in which we're thinking, but actually to the planet itself. We now know that we are in crisis. We now know that we have got to save our planet. We now know that it's the great priority And at last, we're finding ears that are prepared to listen without having holes having to be drilled into them so the words might soak in. I'm really hoping now that within the next 10 to 20 years, there will be a greater idea of the harmony which we require to live on this planet with our planet as a species amongst many, and that perhaps we can begin to appreciate not just our own selves and our creativity, but life in general. One thing that Resonance has taught me is that all life is sacred, and the one thing it's taught me is a great sensitivity to other forms of life. Sitting here on my writing desk with my dog looking at me as I was writing the book, I suddenly became keenly aware that she too is a sentient whole being. And perhaps what we need to do is to see everything in our universe as being conscious, not necessarily to the same level that we are, but conscious all the same. If we started teaching that in our schools, there would be a lot more respect for the people and the animals and the plants and other life forms around us, and also, and more importantly, for each other.
Amelia, thank you for the call. The Schumann resonance, that 7.82 hertz, does that fluctuate? And what would happen, let's say, if our the Earth's electromagnetic field were to change, or, I don't know, collapse, and the Schumann resonant changes? What effect is that going to have on us as a species?
That's a very good question, and one that's answered easily by the onset of an earthquake or a volcano exploding. You'll find that generally what happens, here we are looking for earthquake monitors, we're trying to design machines that can predict when earthquakes are going to happen. All you've actually got to do is go to the hillsides and the mountaintops and watch what animals do, because at the outset of an earthquake, you get a change of frequency that goes out of Schumann resonance. It becomes disharmonic. And it can create all sorts of feelings, including nausea, unsettlement, and illness as well. And animals have a tendency to therefore vacate the area en masse in order to get away from such febrile frequencies. And of course, after the onset of an earthquake, they will return. So you already have that sense of what would happen to us if we lost Earth resonance. We as a species would either have to adapt or die. And I suspect that in the short term, if Schumann resonance was to change, I should think that we would suffer quite significantly as a result of it.
Wildcard line again. Joseph is in San Diego. Joseph, good morning. Welcome to Coast.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I would like to ask your guest if he could speak about the Vedic Sanskrit mantras that, before the Vedas were written 5,000 years ago, they were chanted from guru to disciple and never changed. And according to the knowledge, these mantras were transcendental and could uplift the soul spiritually. And I wonder if you could comment on that. And I'll take his answer up there. Thank you.
I'd like to do that very much. And thank you so much again for a great question. It's interesting you say that, because again, we have mantras and we have yantras as well. Yantras are the pictorial form of these chants, and you see them quite often. You can go online and you can check them out. They're very beautiful constructions that are kind of cosmically aligned. Generally, Buddhist monks in Tibet, they actually make them out of colored sand, etc. But what the question reminds me of is that there's this legend in the UK that back in the time of the Druids and beyond, around about 0 BC to 1000 BC, let's say, that we had perpetual choirs. And what that was, that the sacred places were being chanted and sung 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And, you know, you raise a really good point here, because when we go to Egypt and we look at the pyramids, we go to the Aztec pyramids in Central America, and we go to temples elsewhere, what we generally see are ruins. We see quiet places of silence where things used to happen. Everything is in the past tense. But actually, these were living, breathing places where song and chants were happening 24/7. It was the same for the temple in Jerusalem. We read about the period of Jesus, and we read about the history, we read about the antagonism between Jew and Roman, et cetera, et cetera. But very few people talk about the actual resonance that was happening deep inside the temple and actually reaching outwards and helping to transform people's brainwave patterns, and thus making that civilization, that society, a lot more intense, as the Temple of Jerusalem is a prime example. We look at the pyramid. The pyramid was full of choirs and people singing and chanting and dancing. These were places of joy, the celebration of life. And today, to see them just as sad old ruins, it's a mistake. We should actually look back on them as to what they were. And in many cases, and you'll see this in the great Gothic cathedrals of Europe, they are still living, breathing places where choirs sing most of the day, most of the week, throughout the year.
All right, let's see. I'm going to try to squeeze one in here quickly. Maria's in Illinois. Maria, we'll have to make it a quick, short question. Thank you for calling in.
Hi, thank you for giving, letting me be on the air. I actually had a couple of questions real quick. The first question is, I know that when this is more of a metaphysical question, if you're not able to travel to all these places that there's a lot of vibrational energy, like the pyramids of Giza or like any of the cultic places, if you're basically just, you know, where you're at, wherever that is, could you access any of these energies or vibrational energies with the universe, just if you go out for a walk in nature or at a park, you know, maybe late at night, if you just...
Maria, that's a good question. I'm sorry to cut you short. We're just going to have time for that one question. So, David, if I could get you to address that. How can she access these places out in nature, or can she?
Maria, that's a great question, and thank you very much for asking it. Yes, you can. You can look up online. You know, you don't just have to go to sacred places, but if you actually go deep within yourself and you go for your long walks to parts of the country, go to places where there are rivers and wells, and start just to kind of let go. Don't think in yourself of everyday things. Just go inside yourself. Just let go. And gradually what will happen is you will feel the sense of the power of place when you reach that place properly. You'll feel generally that, you know, there's something going on, a sense of imminence. Now, what happens is basically you've got earth cracks in the earth. Some people call them ley lines. Some people call them fault lines. And out of those fault lines, you'll get emissions of radon gas, which in tandem with the local rock and also with river water, perhaps even holy water, you will gradually begin to absorb all of this, and you will get that sense of place. So carry on looking. And by the way, a good way to start looking as well is look at the poets, the ancient poets from whatever traditions they come from in your area, because they will be a guide as to where you can find those places, because they were inspired by them to write the words that they did. And I wish you all the best.
Okay, Maria, thank you for that. Wow. That was pretty profound. That's this is so uplifting, and it was remarkable speaking with you again, David. Thank you so much for hanging out these last 2 hours.
Richard, it's been a great pleasure, and may I extend my best wishes to your audience and fun with sound and language.
The Ancient Language of Sacred Sound, the 20th Anniversary, 2nd Edition. All right, for George Norrie, George Naples Alliance, Stephanie Smith, Tom Danheiser, Dan Galanti, Michael Cozio, Donna Walker, Chris Burrows, and Ryan Stacey, I'm Richard Serrett. Thank you for your ears and your voices, your beautiful voices. Until next time, so long for now.